Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. 20 million Americans are battling substance use disorder at any given time. Even though there is an opioid crisis that is claiming thousands of lives each year, 74% of people dependent on a substance are addicted to alcohol. 4 million people received treatment for drug or alcohol addiction in 2017. September is National Recovery Month, and recovery is the topic of today's program. Joining us on the show is Pennsylvania Secretary of Drug and Alcohol Programs, Jennifer Smith. Secretary Smith, welcome to the program.
Hi, good morning, Scott. Thanks for having me.
Also joining us today is Jennifer Storm, Director of the State's Office of Victim Advocate and author of the book Blackout Girl. Jennifer Storm, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can also leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Secretary Smith, what's the significance of National Recovery Month?
So September is National Recovery Month here in the United States, and the significance of that month is that we take the opportunity to spread the message of hope. We let people know that treatment really does work and that recovery is absolutely possible. This year's national theme is Join the Voices for Recovery. Together we are stronger. And I kind of like to think about that theme in two parts. The first is Join the Voices for Recovery. And the significance of that part of the theme is that we're encouraging individuals with substance use disorder and their family and friends to speak up about what it means to have substance use disorder and what it means to be impacted by someone who has that disorder, and to not be clouded by the stigma that is often associated with the disease, but instead share your story, let other people know what it means to live with this medical condition. And the second part of the theme is Together We Are Stronger. And that really sends a unifying message to individuals who are struggling to say that if we all work together, all parts of our community, whether it's healthcare, law enforcement, community organizations, school districts, government, local, state, and federal, that if we all work together, that we really can make a difference. And so I've been traveling all across the state this month, celebrating with different communities and recognizing that there's hope in recovery. Just this past weekend, I was in Pittsburgh for their recovery walk. I'll be in Philly next weekend. And it's really cool to get to share with communities the message from state government that says, we're working really hard to ensure that people who are struggling with substance use disorder have access to the services that they need, and that there absolutely is hope for that journey to recovery.
I have to admit that it is hard not getting caught up in the numbers. Mm-hmm. That introduction that I had there, that 20 million Americans at any given time are battling substance use disorder. But 4 million in 2017, 4 million saw treatment. That's only a fifth of the people who are battling this.
Yep.
Why? I mean, why is it that, I mean, that to me, that is a low percentage of, when 20% are seeking treatment, that is a low percentage of those who have an issue.
It is, yeah. And I think there's several reasons for it. I think the biggest, from my perspective, continues to be stigma. There are many individuals with substance use disorder who are not the typical individual that you think of as someone who has an addiction, right? They're not these individuals that are homeless and missing teeth and poorly clothed. These are individuals of all walks of life. And I think many of them are really ashamed to admit to their family and friends or to their medical care providers that, in fact, they have an issue. So I think stigma is a huge part of it. Certainly funding, insurance coverage is another big challenge that we continue to hear about. Folks don't realize that if you don't have insurance or if your insurance is has really high copays and deductibles, that there actually is money that comes from the federal government to the states, in the form of a block grant that is used to pay for those individuals. So folks don't understand that if they don't have insurance, they can still access really quality treatment services. So we have to continue to get that message out. And then I think there's still probably a small percentage, and this I'm speaking more in terms of Pennsylvania than I am nationally, still a small percentage in Pennsylvania where I think access to the right services in a particular geographic area can be a challenge.
When you say right services, I was thinking big picture, are there enough beds?
That's a great question. We try not to use the word beds so much anymore, treatment slots,
okay,
right?
Yeah.
But yes, there definitely are some capacity issues in different areas. I think what the challenge is that the drug and alcohol treatment system is, comprised of a continuum of services, all the way from intervention and prevention type services through treatment and then recovery supports. And within that treatment realm, there are many, many different types of treatment services. Some are inpatient, some are outpatient, some are hospital-based. And so when you're assessed, it's determined what's the most clinically appropriate course of treatment for you. And then it's a matter of locating where a facility is that provides those services. And in some case, we have concentrations of those services in places that may be outside of the county that you reside in. And so people are a little more reluctant to leave their home county to go for those services. So we definitely do have some difficulty matching up where the needs are with where we have available capacity. The challenge is that needs number changes on a daily basis. I mean, every day we're assessing new individuals and determining where within that continuum of services they need to be. So I think from a state perspective, we're working to try to build up all those levels of care and trying to ensure that we have relationships cross-county, that if in fact we need to send folks from one county to another to receive those services, that we have a good mechanism in place to do that.
And when you use the word right, matching people to the right services, mm-hmm. Something else I thought of is the length of treatment.
Yeah.
I mean, for some reason, we as a society settled on 28 days.
Yeah.
Well, 4 weeks. I think that, from the conversations I've had over the years, for most people, that is not enough, correct?
Yeah. And when we're talking about kind of length in treatment, people get this misconception that we're talking about 28 days in an inpatient program. And really what we need to think about when we talk about length of treatment is the length of time that an individual is engaged in treatment services, which could mean that they're in an inpatient setting for 60 days and then they move to an outpatient setting and they're going to be in that setting for, 3 more years. So we need to start looking at kind of that length of stay term more as over the continuum of services. How long have they been engaged in treatment? Because that's what's most important. Our clinicians are going to be assessing on a daily, regular basis what is most appropriate in terms of inpatient, outpatient, hospital-based, non-hospital-based. And that shouldn't really matter when we're talking about engagement in treatment. That's a clinical decision. Mm-hmm. But you are absolutely right that there is this misconception that the best form of treatment is an inpatient stay for 28 days. And the reality is that that's just not true for most people. And we really have to be open to assessing the individual for exactly the needs and the services that need to be provided to them to best suit their needs.
40-60% of those who battle a substance use disorder will relapse.
Mm-hmm.
Is that length? Does that have something to do with it? Or what are the reasons for the relapses?
It could, but it may not. Addiction is by definition a chronic relapsing brain disease. So it is unfortunately quite common that individuals do relapse. It doesn't mean that their initial treatment stay failed. It doesn't mean that their current recovery supports weren't providing the support that they needed. It may mean that there was a trigger in their life. Maybe they experienced some kind of trauma, which I think Jen's going to talk about here in a little bit. There's lots of reasons that could cause that particular relapse. So it doesn't necessarily mean that the treatment wasn't appropriate, but in some cases it could. If you're seeing that relapse so shortly after a treatment stay, that could indicate that maybe they weren't engaged in treatment services long enough, or maybe it wasn't the right level of care. But I think in general, we have to just do a better job of ensuring that once people successfully complete those treatment stays, that they're staying engaged in some kind of supportive service activity, whether that's through community organizations, whether it's through self-help groups, whether it's, you know, some other connection to the recovering community. It's really important that, you know, treatment doesn't just stop the day you walk out of a treatment program, that we have to continue to provide those services to help reduce the risk of the relapse.
Jennifer Storm, you've been on the program many times where we've talked about, as part of your role as the director of the Office of Victim Advocate here in Pennsylvania, that is not why you are necessarily here today. As I mentioned in the introduction, you're the author of several books. Your first book was Blackout Girl, which told your story. By the way, being made into, would you call it a documentary film?
Definitely a documentary film,
okay.
Yes.
In the near future, and we'll talk about that too. But one of the things you wanted to talk about and that you do talk about in the book is that trauma can often lead to, I don't know whether I should say can often, can sometimes, it's a risk factor for substance use disorder. Tell us about your story.
Absolutely. Well, that was my story. So, you know, I came from a family that was predisposed to the disease of addiction and alcoholism. So it was in my family.
That's a risk factor,
it's
too.
It's a risk factor, right? And it's the number one risk factor, especially when we're looking at women. But then I also had a trauma, which is the number two risk factor for women. And I was raped when I was 12 years old. And I had no real coping mechanisms. My family didn't know how to deal with it. And so I was kind of left to my own dysfunctional devices. And those devices ended up being drugs and alcohol. And that's because when you go through something that's so traumatic, you want to avoid, you want to escape, you want to run from the kind of catechism of emotions that trauma brings. And so I was riddled with shame and fear and guilt. And so my knee-jerk reaction was avoid these feelings. I didn't know what to do with them, and so I wanted to avoid them. And it was easy to do that when I would drink, when I would use drugs, because they would create this false sense of nothingness. You know, they would numb me out temporarily. However, in hindsight, when I look back, usually other things then would happen, and I'd wake up the next day, and I'd not only still have the fear, the guilt, the shame, but then I'd have additional fear, guilt, and shame because I got so intoxicated the night before that I ended up behaving in ways that I wasn't proud of, or I let people down, or I lied, or I skipped school, or broke rules. And so when I look at it now, I see that it was this cycle of destruction. But back then, it was a solution, and it was the only solution I had. And it was a survival solution.
But was it a conscious solution? I mean, when you're 15 years old and you're drinking, I mean, are you drinking saying, okay, this will make me forget about the rape? Or is it just that, okay, I feel better when I'm drunk?
It's an avoidance tactic, right? So you get the flood of the emotions, and then the emotions overwhelm you. And so then for me, it was this need to alleviate those emotions. So sometimes I did that through self-harm. But usually it was drugs and alcohol, because as soon as I engaged in drugs and alcohol, it did what I was looking for. It numbed it out. It kept me from feeling. And so when I talk to young people now, they don't recognize their use as an immediate kind of reaction to their trauma. But when we start to dig down into, well, what was happening for you before you did? And what were the feelings? Then we can start to have a real conversation about it being used as a coping mechanism, as in a way to avoid and a way to escape.
Now, one of the things that I find, I hate to call it your story, but in your life, that is so remarkable is how forthcoming you've been in the book, Blackout Girl, and when you do speak in public. So to the audience, questions I'm asking are publicly known.
Absolutely.
You tried to take your own life.
Yes.
Were you high? Were you drunk?
Oh, incredibly, yeah. So I had a couple superficial suicide attempts when I was younger. And when I say superficial, I don't mean that to discount suicide. I was really trying to get someone to pay attention to me. And I was hurting, and I didn't have the words with which to seek help. So I engaged in some behaviors that wound up getting me into different treatment facilities. That was when I was younger. But I was in addiction from ages 12 to 22. And it progressed. It started with alcohol and then marijuana and then pills. It was really anything to help me conceal. But what happens as you continue to push away trauma and you continue to have more traumatic experiences in your life, you need more substances to keep up with the amount of trauma you're trying to cover up. So I eventually escalated into cocaine and then crack cocaine addiction by age 15, 16. So when I was 22, I hit an incredibly horrific place in my life. My mother had just died in my arms in July of 1997, and I just was desperate, and I had no hope, and I didn't think that I could get out of the pain that I was in. And I didn't think that there were resources that would work. I didn't have the ability to admit that I had a problem because, again, I continued to see that it wasn't a problem. It was the solution. What started happening, though, is I had so much pain that didn't matter how many drugs and alcohol. It didn't matter how much there was. It just didn't conceal the pain. It was my fix wasn't working anymore. And so, yeah, I attempted to very brutally take my life in November of 1997. And thank God I survived.
Mm-hmm. Something along those lines that an aside, I guess I hate to call it an aside, but I think it goes to point out that a lot of times when you are using drugs and alcohol, that you don't make good decisions, and that includes the people that you associate with.
Of
course. That a lot of times that keeps it going.
Yeah.
I mean, you had a roommate that walked in after you had attempted suicide, mm-hmm. and saw that you were in bad shape, and mm-hmm. she asked if she could have your furniture.
Yeah. Well, she was a nurse in her nursing uniform. She had just come home from work, but she was also a drug addict, just like me. That's why we were living together. Like you said, as you start to kind of close yourself off from productive people, you engage in people who are doing what you're doing. So at this point in my life, I was living in this skanky two-bedroom apartment above a bar in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. And I was rotting away, and I was high every day, all day. I worked at the bar beneath me, which was very convenient, and I didn't leave that place really very much for about 3 months. And so, yeah, she came home and saw me, and I mean, I was bleeding out onto the coffee table in front of us because I had brutally sliced my wrists, and I was out of cigarettes. And so she looked at me, she's like, well, what are you doing? And I just said, just leave me alone, let me die. I think I said something like that. And then I said, can you get me more cigarettes? I'm out of cigarettes. So she literally walked downstairs, got a pack of cigarettes for me, came back up, gave them to me, and then left. And just left me there to die.
But she asked if she could have
my furniture. She
asked
if she could have my furniture. And she actually followed through with that request after I ended up in rehab when my dad and my brothers were cleaning out my apartment. She was like, no, Jen said I could have this stuff. And my dad was like, my dad took everything, including the toilet seat. He was so mad.
Whatever happened to her?
You know, I don't know. I think she's still in the area. She has not reached out to me. I have not reached out to her. You know, I have forgiveness for her because she was just as sick as I was in her addiction. And, you know, I don't have any ill will towards her because that doesn't serve me.
Mm. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. You can see some of the programs that we're working on, future Smart Talks, like amending the state's law regarding fireworks and changing the state's science curriculum in schools. We invite you to join in by going WITF.org/smarttalk, sharing some questions in advance, or sending us a voice memo or leaving voicemail. Again, go to WITF.org/smarttalk. Today we're talking about National Recovery Month and recovery from substance use disorder. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call. Maybe an experience to tell. Doesn't have to be yours or something else that you know, you've witnessed. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So, Jennifer Storm, what made you decide to seek treatment after that?
I think it was just the reality that I woke up, that I survived, right? So I vividly recall waking up in a psych ward in Lehigh Valley Hospital, because that's where they, you know, put you when you do that, and seeing the bandaging on my wrists and having a doctor tell me that I was lucky to be alive, and I believed him. And I don't know what happens. You know, some people call it a moment of clarity. They call it a spiritual awakening. I don't know what it was, but I just knew that, well, if that didn't work, there's got to be something else for me. And then shortly thereafter, when they started to do my intake and assessment, I admitted that I had a problem. And so I think it was the surviving that incident and then coupled with me finally admitting that, okay, drugs and alcohol are the problems. And then I started to really identify that everything negative that had happened in those 10 years had been as a result of my addiction in some way, sort of, right? We'll talk about sexual violence differently. Those are never the victim's responsibility or fault, regardless of what's being engaged in. But I was involved in the justice system at certain points. I was making horrible decisions. I was losing jobs. I got kicked out of houses. You know, I did not have a very successful 10 years in addiction. And so I think it was just the fact that I survived, and I was given hope, and I just leant on that hope, and I leaned on it, and I leaned on other people.
Do you ever relapse?
I did not, but I think it's important to acknowledge, and I like, Jen, what you were saying. I have a saying that relapse is not failure, it's feedback. And I think all too often individuals end up relapsing because our treatment facilities have not yet caught up with a lot of the underlining causations of use. And often, if you scratch beneath the surface, trauma is there. There's some form of traumatic childhood experience. There's some form of traumatic experience in adulthood that has not been treated properly. And there's trigger in that person's life, and then that trigger leads to use. You know, I often call our treatment facilities their Band-Aids. We put Band-Aids on bullet wounds. And because there's this short length of stay, there's this, 28-day, this arbitrary 28-day, and access is such a big issue, we have a lot of people that are walking around with significant emotional wounds that they are managing with drugs and alcohol. But our treatment facilities don't have the capacity to really dig into that trauma and to begin to really heal it, which then allows for new coping mechanisms.
Mm-hmm. And from time to time, throw in some of these statistics and some of the things that are risk factors. You mentioned genetics as one of the big ones, but trauma is another.
Trauma is the second leading cause, especially for women.
And also environment, as how you grew up. If you see parents, you see drugs and alcohol in your home, if there has been sexual abuse or domestic violence, I mean, all those things that can be classified as trauma, these are all risk factors that many people who are suffering from substance use disorder have experienced in their lifetimes. Secretary Smith, Jen just told her story and talked about trauma, but something that you had said earlier, you said that many people won't talk about it because of the stigma. But there's something else to that as well. And that is, we've often heard that first you have to admit that there is a problem. That many people, even if family members, loved ones, spouses, friends, come to someone and say, I think you have a problem that could use some help, some treatment, that they'll say, no, I'm okay, I can handle it. So stigma is one thing, but admitting a problem is another, isn't it?
Yeah, I think you're right. And some would argue that there's self-stigma as well, which is, I think, sort of what you're getting at, that folks have a really hard time even admitting to themselves that there's an issue and that help is available and that they shouldn't be ashamed to ask for it. So sometimes even when they recognize that there's a problem, they're too ashamed to admit that they recognize that there's a problem. You know, I think in our society today, we try to encourage everybody to be strong about things, you know, and you shouldn't cry. We even teach our kids this, you know, oh, don't cry. It'll be fine. Don't cry. And I think that sends the message that it's not okay to be weak and to admit that you need help. And so I think this dips into Jen's world a lot, too, in terms of sexual violence and trauma, that we really need to teach our young people better coping skills these days and how to recognize what emotions they're feeling and then what do we do with those emotions when we're feeling them. So instead of turning to drugs and alcohol, what are other healthy ways that we can deal with these things? How do we acknowledge that we're struggling? How do we ask for help? So from my perspective, you know, in the world of drug and alcohol prevention, it's not just about educating kids about what are drugs and alcohol? How does it affect the body? You know, we've been doing that for decades.
As I said earlier, you can get caught up in the numbers.
We've been doing that for decades, but really providing them the actual life skills that they need to deal with what these underlying issues are that are causing them to turn there in the first place, which often are things like trauma, peer pressure, things like that. So let's teach them properly how to identify that in themselves and deal with it. And I think we'll start to see some changes in terms of their ability to cope with those events differently in their life and not turn to substances.
Let's take a phone call from Kira in Glen Rock. Kira, you're on the air.
Hi, I just wanted to say thank you for sharing your story, Jen. I grew up in Philadelphia. I lived in Kensington right in the height of the opiate crisis, and we moved 8 months ago to Glen Rock. And I'm thinking I'm running away from the opiate problem to live really close to York City, and you see it here. And sometimes you forget that it's people that have issues. And I just want to thank you for just helping me empathize that anyone can be affected by the opiate crisis. It starts with pain that needs to be addressed. And when it's not addressed, it turns into something else. But I just wanted to thank you for sharing your story.
Thank you, Kara, very much.
Kara, thank you very much for your call. So let's talk, and I don't want to get back into numbers, but I will mention some. of those 20 million people who are suffering from substance use disorder, 38% are addicted to drugs, dependent on drugs, as opposed to 75% that are dependent on alcohol. We'll talk about the alcohol in just a moment. Mm-hmm. That may surprise some people because we have heard so much in the last few years about the opioid crisis. Now, part of that is because there have been so many overdose deaths in Pennsylvania and across the country. But again, those numbers may surprise some people that it's a little more than a third of those who are dependent on drugs and not necessarily opioids.
You make a great point. And you're absolutely right that the reason we get so much attention is because the deaths are so apparent. You know, individuals with opioid use disorder, you're hearing about how taxing it is on first responders, how they're clogging up emergency rooms, how they're overdosing and being revived multiple times. And then
which
you
is
read
all
these
true.
Obituaries. It is true. It is true. And by the way, I'm going to put a quick plug in. Because this is National Recovery Month, both this Wednesday and next Wednesday, the state is hosting a 2 free naloxone days across the state. So about 95 different locations across the state. This Wednesday will be open from 11 to 7. Next Wednesday, they'll be open from 9 to 5. You can find those locations on the Department of Health's website. So if you're interested in picking up some free naloxone and helping to save a life, please do that. The deaths are very visible. I think what people often forget is that alcohol is really still the number one killer. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't kill quite as immediately, and I'll use the word violently, as opioid overdose can. It's not so in your face. Mm-hmm. It's often a much longer term process. There's still a lot of medical costs associated with individuals that suffer from alcohol use disorder, but you're not seeing those all at one time, and you're not always seeing them showing up in the emergency departments the way that you see overdose victims showing up. What we've learned through implementing the warm handoff process, which is that process to get overdose survivors from the ED into treatment, what we found in looking at some of our county data is that individuals presenting with an overdose, and I'm making air quotes for the people who can't see me doing that right now, people presenting with an overdose in some of those counties are actually being referred at a higher rate for alcohol use disorder than they are for opioids or stimulants. So I think what we're doing from a state perspective is trying to utilize the federal grant money that we're getting right now, using the attention that's being placed on opioids, and trying to build a drug and alcohol treatment system and programming that is relevant to all substances, because I don't know that we're going to get to a point in our society where alcohol is given the attention that it needs to be. And there's a lot of reasons for that. You know, it's a legal substance as opposed to illegal. The stigma is very different. So we're doing the best that we can to ensure the programming that we're creating is relevant for individuals suffering from any substance use disorder, including alcohol.
Well, when you talk about alcohol being a legal product, it's also socially acceptable for most of our society, too.
Yes, it is.
And that
and very accessible.
And very accessible, yeah. So that
more so today.
That plays a big role in it that says, oh, he's only drinking. Thank God he's not using heroin or cocaine or something like that. He's only drinking, you know. And unfortunately, there are a lot of people who think that way.
Yeah. And not only is it not frowned upon, but even for some age groups, it's like a badge of honor, right? I mean, if you're a college student who goes to parties and gets drunk on a regular basis, that makes you cooler than other kids. So we really have a lot of work to do in terms of education, but really kind of changing the stigma around alcohol usage.
Mm. Jen, I saw you nodding vigorously as Secretary Smith was talking.
Well, because it can be really frustrating, right? Cause, so deaths in America, like I think she had indicated, alcohol is the number one cause. And so there was a 10-year study recently done by the University of Washington, so I'll give you some numbers. And it showed that deaths among women rose 85% due to alcoholism. And deaths for men rose 29%. We also know, and this will tie in really my role as the victim advocate too, that alcohol is still the number one facilitator of sexual violence and sexual assault. It's the most accessible. It's a societal norm. It's easier. And when so there was a study by the American Journal on Addictions that said 75% of all women seeking treatment are coming in with an underlying sexual violence. I would tell you that that's probably 90%, right? Because we know sexual assault is one of the most underreported crimes. And anecdotally, in my research for the film, when I've been reaching out to treatment facilities, every person I talk to will say, oh, no, that's more like 90%, 95%. Almost every woman coming into treatment is also identifying in some way with some untreated sexual assault.
And along those same lines, too, with alcohol use, domestic violence as well. Almost every case you hear of a woman in particular that has been the victim of domestic violence,
absolutely.
Oh, he came home drunk and he got angry and he took it out on me. You know, that story is just, you hear it all the time.
You do. And we know that alcohol doesn't create violence, right? There's definitely something else going on with that. People, I know a lot of very nonviolent individuals in recovery, and I know a lot of nonviolent people who still drink every
day. We've heard people who said he's a mean drunk.
He's a mean drunk, right? It can certainly exacerbate those tendencies and those qualities. But we know that alcohol is also, it's the social norm. And right now, women have been, I think, in particularly marketed to and targeted. You know, I don't know how many times you go into Target, you go into Walmart, there's always the shirts with mommy needs wine to get through the day, or, you know, mommy's sippy cup is filled with Chardonnay. And we make a joke of it, but it's really, there are so many women who are suffering in silence with alcoholism, and they feel like they have nowhere to turn. And so access to services is not, and it's not at the top of our radar. It's not at the top of our prevention radar. And I agree, individuals are not presenting when they die of alcoholism, which again, they're dying at the highest rate. They're presenting with liver failure, heart failure, pancreatitis. You know, I have known so many young people in my life who have died solely from alcoholism in the past 10 years. It's devastating, but their death certificates don't say that. It's not an overdose. It's a long progressive disease that destroys your organs and then leads to death.
We have an email from Nancy who says, how is it that some people are high functioning at work, but then addictive at home?
Oh, that's a tough question to answer.
Yeah.
I think it probably has to do with just the fact that they're a highly functioning individual with substance use disorder. And, you know, I think individuals who are very, very progressed in their disease, most of us would not recognize them if we saw them on the street. You know, it gets back to, again, people with substance use disorder aren't necessarily that image that you imagine of being dirty and homeless and stinky and having all kinds of, you know, physical, visible issues. Some of these folks are people who have been abusing pills for decades, and that's how you've always known them. And so their behavior never seems out of the norm because that's what you know them to behave like.
Most people think addicts or alcoholics are out of control all the time. And oftentimes it's the exact opposite, right? And especially if, so for me, the reason I was using is because I needed to be in control of my emotional state, which led me to being kind of out of control of it, if that makes any sense. but the foundation of it was control. So many individuals who are abusing substances, they're doing it to control something. It's either the feelings, the emotions, you know. So they're highly functional. They can get through the entire day, and then at 5 o'clock, they will drink themselves into oblivion. That is still the definition of an alcoholic, and that often is what leads to I think the stigma and people's lack of access to services, because they think, well, I'm not an alcoholic because I only drink on Friday and Saturday nights. But if you drink on Friday and Saturday nights to the excess that you don't recall anything, and you know, bad things happen, you probably have a drinking problem. But control is a huge element of it. And so it tends to mar what we think of as a person who needs assistance or needs treatment.
We have an email from a listener who says that a friend's son finally told his family about his addiction to alcohol. He had lost his job and hit rock bottom. For 25 years, he didn't feel that he could tell his parents about his addiction, and this tears up his mom. She is so glad that he did, as he is really doing well now.
That's wonderful.
So happy to hear that.
Yeah. It kind of goes to the theme of Natural Recovery Month when you talk about hope and that it does work.
Yeah. Yeah, and that these folks, stories like this, they have to speak up. They have to let other people know who are struggling in silence that there is help out there, that it's okay to talk about it, you know, that recovery is possible, but only if you take the step to try to seek the treatment in the first place.
And you have to appreciate that we come from a program, right? I'm doing program in air quotes as well.
That's two air quotes on radio.
Lots of air
today.
Quotes. But our recovery programs have historically been anonymous, and that there's been a really strong foundation and a purpose for that, because people need a place to go where they can heal without the stigma. But it's also been a barrier. And I think, you know, Scott, you had mentioned in the beginning that of how transparent I am. For me, it was about, I know people are suffering. I know that there's so much stigma and silence around this that I need to tell other people, because if I can heal, then other people can heal. And if I can recover, then others can recover. And there's strength in numbers. People need to know that these programs work and that there is hope and that there's possibility. And so it's almost antithetical to the anonymous portion of recovery. But I love that our whole recovery community has finally embraced survivors telling their stories, and those of us in recovery acknowledging that we're in recovery so that other people know that it's real.
Have you ever gotten bad reactions to telling your story?
Yeah. So when I first got clean and sober, I did so in Pennsylvania. I went to a rehab, then I went to a halfway house in Lancaster, and then for some reason I moved to Penn State, which I jokingly say I moved to like the number one drinking college to get sober. But that's where I ended up. And when I went to school, you know, I went to college and I did so sober, I got a lot of negative feedback, mainly because I tried to be a college student. So I was the president of my sorority and I would go to parties, and there were a couple close calls. Like, I'll never forget a night at a frat party where I had a guy who just like cornered me because I refused a shot because they were handing out shots. And I'd always go with like my SoBe tea. I always had something, you know, alternative in my hands. I always had an exit plan. But he like cornered me in this house and was just screaming at me with a bottle over my head about like, how dare I insult him and not take this, and mocking my recovery. And so it definitely made me reevaluate like where I should really be going early in sobriety, you know. But I was young and I wanted to still be young. But for the most part, I have had absolute acceptance and pure love when I've been brutally honest. I mean, in job interviews, when I got hired as the executive director of the Victim Witness Assistance Program, and in my story, I told my story, right? In my interview, I was honest, and I got hired. You know, when I got appointed to this position, in the press release, I'll never forget, Dave Freed, the district attorney, was like, you know,
Cumberland County, now the U.S. Attorney, Middle District.
Yeah. Referenced my book and was like, you know, here's a success story. And so I feel incredibly privileged that my story has not been stigmatized. It's been celebrated. And I want others' stories to be celebrated in that same way.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Listen tomorrow on Smart Talk. Sue Klebold, the mother of Columbine shooter Dylan Klebold, she's also written a book and has a lot of information about her life after the Columbine shooting, but also a lot of emphasis on suicide prevention and mental health, where she calls it brain health, and what we should be looking for. Go to our website to get an outlook of conversations we're working on. Plus, you can leave a voicemail or voice memo for Sue Klebold that's coming up on tomorrow's program. Go to WITF.org/smarttalk. Our guest today, Pennsylvania Secretary of Drug and Alcohol Programs Jennifer Smith, and Jennifer Storm, Director of the state's Office of Victim Advocate and author of the book Blackout Girl, which will soon be a film. We'll talk about that in just a moment. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. I just wanted to follow up on what I was just promoting about Sue Klebold appearing on the program tomorrow. Dylan Klebold, her son, no drugs, mm-hmm. no alcohol, little bit of, okay, maybe just a little, but not...
A smidge.
Not... in no way was he dependent on it. But what the Klebolds realized afterwards was that the mental illness, or mm-hmm. she calls it brain health, that he was very depressed and thought his life was worth nothing. You know, she sees the shooting as more of a suicide. There may be some people who would disagree with that. But the reason I bring that point up is that of those 20 million Americans who are suffering from substance use disorder, almost half of them have some type of brain health issue, mental illness that goes along with it. So that makes it even more difficult.
Yeah, it absolutely does. And, you know, some people kind of get caught up in that, you know, chicken egg argument about, well, do they have the mental health issue and that's why they got addicted to the substances, or did they have the substance use disorder issue first and then, you know, that helped develop or is masking itself as something else? And, you know, my response is kind of, who cares? You know, the reality is that they have two very clear disorders that need to be dealt with. And I think we have some work to do in terms of building both drug and alcohol treatment facilities that are really capable of providing adequate mental health services, as well as working with our mental health providers in better identifying where there's underlying substance use disorder issues and ensuring that either their clinicians know how to help treat that or are partnering with drug and alcohol treatment facilities to provide the support that's necessary to address the substance use disorder issue. So that blend and that partnership between the drug and alcohol world and the mental health world needs to be a lot closer, in my opinion.
Very few people, fortunately, will resort to a mass shooting, committing a mass shooting. But Jen Storm, as your familiarity with the criminal justice system, mm-hmm. as you well know, that there is a high percentage of those who go to jail mm-hmm. who are suffering from some type of mental illness.
Yep.
And the drugs and alcohol play a major role in crimes that have been committed.
Absolutely. I mean, we know that people who are justice involved traditionally are coming from environments that are either it's poverty, it's high rates of crime exposure that they've witnessed or been victims themselves. And so then that leads us to trauma. And then often trauma is concealed by the use of drugs and alcohol, which then lead to not great decision making. I'm really proud of the Office of Victim Advocate. We are about to do a pilot program in Muncie Prison, which is one of our all-female prisons, because we realize that hurt people, we also appreciate that heal people. So we are bringing Stephanie Covington's Beyond Trauma model into Muncie Prison. We're going to do a 17-week pilot with women there just to start talking about their exposure to violence and their exposure to trauma, and to hopefully try to help heal that so that when they do leave our prisons, they do so as healed individuals and they're rehabilitated and they can go into their communities and make better decisions.
We have an email asking, how does Al-Anon message differ from your own message? From what I understand, the Al-Anon message is a tougher one.
Well, so Al-Anon, yeah. I mean, so it's obviously it's a supportive mechanism for friends and families who are, you know, who loved someone who is addicted. And so some programs have a real hands-off approach where, you know, oftentimes enabling becomes the identifying problem for the loved one who, you know, loves someone who's in their substance use disorder. And so often it's that tough love approach, and it's that pull the, you know, the rug out from under them so that they hit the rock bottom. And I go back and forth. I don't really know that that approach is necessarily 100% productive. You know, my parents, my father specifically, was incredibly forgiving and emotionally supportive and loved me through all of it. Didn't mean that I always made the best decisions, but when I was ready to make the decision, he was there and he was one of my strongest support mechanisms. So some of his enabling kept me alive. Some of his enabling probably kept me in my addiction a little bit longer too. So I think there's a balance there. Tough love isn't always the answer. Sometimes tough love could be the reason that person is using, because they haven't experienced love and compassion and support.
You relied on your dad a lot.
A lot, yeah.
And unfortunately, he passed away a while back. Sorry for your loss. I think I told you that before. But does it make it more difficult not having that person to provide the kind of support that your father did?
Yeah. I mean, of course, now you're going to Oprah me and make me cry on radio. yeah. And I think about him every day. And he sends me messages every day. You know, it's always through song. Today it was Otis Redding's On the Dock of the Bay, because that was a song we used to sing. And yesterday it was The Stylistic. So it's always something. But or butterflies. We were talking about butterflies before we came in. But it does. But I think what my foundation in recovery has given me is the capacity to withstand anything now, because I have done so much work in therapy and in recovery, that no matter how great the loss is, I can manage it today, and I do it with healthy coping mechanisms. And nothing is going to ever make me pick up a drug or a drink again. And that's the beauty of recovery, and it's an option for people. It's possible.
Let's take a call from Paige in Mechanicsburg. Paige, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to say thank you for sharing. I was listening to the part where you were talking about alcohol is a progression and that it affects our health, but on death certificates, it doesn't necessarily say died of alcoholism. And I think hearing that out loud made me realize that I'm a high-functioning alcoholic. I'm a mom. I'm involved in our community. I've never drank in public. So no one knows. And it started off drinking at night, having wine, then drinking wine in the middle of the day, then drinking wine in the morning. And it's affecting my health. Mm-hmm. And I feel like it's going to kill me. But yet I feel like if I don't drink, it will kill me. So it's like a non-win in both situations. And it's the first time I've heard a show.
So Paige,
it resonates.
Paige, have you sought treatment?
I went to AA last year, and I couldn't relate in the sense that I've never woken up not mm-hmm. knowing where I am, mm-hmm. or I've not had a DUI, and it doesn't necessarily relate to me. What about the moms who have trauma from childhood? And the doctors put you on Klonopin, and Klonopin stops working. And so you start drinking to mask the pain. And then you have to still get up and make breakfast and pack lunches and take kids to ballet and soccer and hold it all together. But you're really dying, but we don't talk about it.
Well,
where do you go for help? When I'm not just referring to me, because I know I'm probably not alone, Mm-mm. but I didn't see those women at AA.
Yeah. You're definitely not alone. And, you know, so in recovery, we have to find the solution that works for us. And sometimes those 12-step meetings aren't going to always be the answer. And that's why there are so many different options. I can tell you this, though, that your feelings, while they feel like they're going to kill you, I promise you that your feelings will not. And exposing them in a safe environment with a trained professional will only lead to healing. And so I would definitely ask that you continue on your journey of looking for that space, whether it's a therapist's office. Jen, I know you have a number.
Yeah. So, you know, if you're just looking to talk to somebody and figure out what your options are and someone that's not going to judge you, please make use of, we have a hotline number. It's 1-800-662-HELP. And it's staffed by individuals who are in recovery themselves. So they'll just listen if that's all you want. They'll provide you resources to support groups if that's what you'd like. If you'd really like to get connected to treatment, they'll help with that. And it really doesn't matter whether you have insurance or don't have insurance or have no idea how you're going to pay for it. Don't let money be the barrier. These folks know exactly how to navigate the system and get the funding that's necessary. So please make use of that hotline. Again, the number is 1-800-662-HELP, and it is available 24/7, 365 days a year.
Paige, do you want help?
Absolutely. I'm dying, and I'm in my 40s, and alcohol has become greater than the symptoms, which is, I would never, but it's. I feel like I'm not helpable, and I feel like
you are absolutely helpful. You are helpable.
The pain and the trauma is so severe from unresolved abuse and domestic violence that when you're out of hope, it's hard to see a light or a solution. But really, I just wanted to say, if I hadn't heard this story today, I would have gone along feeling alone and isolated in the culture that we tend to isolate and feel alone. And so I just wanted to really say thank you.
Paige, could we put you on hold?
Absolutely.
Okay. I want to thank both of our guests for being with us today. Pennsylvania Secretary of Drug and Alcohol Programs, Jennifer Smith, and Jennifer Storm, Director of the State's Office of Victim Advocate. Jennifer, when's the film Blackout Girl come out?
Hopefully in 2020.
Thank both of you for being with us today.
Thanks, Scott.